Chayata Om Mune Mune Maha Munaye Soha Chayata Om Mune Mune Maha Munaye Soha Bhagawan, with equal compassion for all, whose name, when merely heard, dispels the suffering of the lower realms, dispeller of disease and the three poisons, I prostrate to Medicine Buddha, Lapis Light. Tayata Om Bekanse Bekanse Maha Bekanse Bekanse Rajasamudgate Soha Tayata Om Bekanse Bekanse Maha Bekanse Bekanse Rajasamudgate Soha Tayata Om Bekanse Bekanse Maha Bekanse Bekanse Rajasamudgate Soha Tayata Om Bekanse Bekanse Maha Bekanse Bekanse Rajasamudgate Soha Tayata Om Bekanse Bekanse Maha Bekanse Bekanse Rajasamudgate Soha Tayata Om Bekanse Bekanse Maha Bekanse Bekanse Rajasamudgate Soha Tayata Om Bekanse Bekanse Maha Bekanse Bekanse Rajasamudgate Soha. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And now we'll say Chenrezig's mantra. Om Mani Padme Hum, 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 Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. And Green Tara's mantra. Om Tari Tu Tari Ture Soha. 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 And the children are free to go to their classes?
Now he's not a child. Just so good morning. Let me just take a sip of whatever this is. So I'd like to, for us to do a little meditation together, because I understand some, as we said, some of you are new. Is there a little reverberation? Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, there's a strange kind of...
Do I have this on right?
She's like an echo.
Yeah. Do I have this on right?
Yeah. Just a little bit closer.
Is it closer to my big mouth? Hello? Testing? Okay. So in a little while we'll do a little bit of meditation, and maybe to introduce those of you who are new to that, but I thought I would begin by mentioning a little bit about these things that we're chanting at the beginning, because some of you may be a bit, you know, what's this? The first thing that we recited here is labeled in your book Shakyamuni Buddha Mantra. So you probably are familiar with the name Buddha, as like Buddhism. Shakyamuni Buddha is the proper name of the individual who was born in India some 2,500 years ago, just north of India, sort of Nepal, what's now Nepal, and became enlightened. And a representation, a very beautiful representation, the yellow, golden-colored body on the wall there, that is called Shakyamuni Buddha. He was born in a tribe, family lineage called the Shakya lineage. When he was a young boy, he was prophesied to be, he was going to be someone really remarkable. He would either become a universal king or a king that ruled vast territory, or he would become a great spiritual teacher. And his father preferred, is it the former? The former. So he would carry on the lineage. But he exhibited many spiritual qualities. Once during the plowing ceremony, kind of like our May Day, the king was giving the okay for people to plow the fields with the golden plow and big celebrations, people, you know, picnics and everything. And the young child, who was at that time called Siddhartha, he sat under a tree and meditated. He's just a little boy, and he meditated all during the morning and afternoon, and people were quite amazed. And they referred to him as a Muni. Have you ever heard that word? Not M-O-O-N-E-Y, M-U-N-I, which like in his name, Shakyamuni, he was called the Muni of the Shakya clan, because Muni is someone who is an Indian word for sage, or someone who has control. The mantra that we recite afterwards, this thing that we chant, is called a mantra. Tadyata means, may it, you know, this is how it is, Tadyata. Om Mune Mune Maha Munaye Svaha. So that it's kind of a play on his name, Muni, but it's spelled M-U-N-E because in Sanskrit that's kind of like the vocative. Do you know what, you know about grammar? You know what the vocative case is? Like if I say, Jason! That's, you know, with the exclamation mark, I'm calling him out. Or Charlie. Oh. He understood the vocative case. He immediately put it up his head. We don't, usually in our grammar, it's just like an exclamation mark after something. Yeah. So this is kind of calling out the Muni. Mune, Mune. Maha Munaye Svaha. So what it's one way of interpreting that is calling to the Buddha, the Shakyamuni Buddha, who has control over all of his emotions and everything like that, calling out to him to provide that same kind of control to us, sort of like asking blessings. Then we recited this little stanza of the Medicine Buddha, and just to the left of the representation of Shakyamuni Buddha, there's another one, dark blue, meant to be lapis lazuli, another Buddha who's almost in the same posture as Shakyamuni. His hand is at his waist holding a bowl, whereas Shakyamuni's bowl is holding nectars that can soothe the mind and bring some control, the Medicine Buddha, the blue-colored Buddha, lapis lazuli colored Buddha is holding some medicinal plants. He's called the healing Buddha. And in Sanskrit, his name is Baishanze, or here, Baikanze, the way the Tibetans pronounce it, Baikanze Guru. The medicine, the healing guru. And you know what guru means? Does anyone not know the word guru? Do you know where that word comes from? The etymology, in Sanskrit, the word refers to something heavy. So when I was a sort of teenager, you know, we had our own lingo, just like today people have their own way of, you know, colloquialisms. Who said, man, that's heavy. That meant that was something substantial or good. It didn't mean you were fat or anything like that. So guru kind of has that meaning, someone who's heavy in spiritual qualities. So here it's Bekanze, Bekanze, Maha Bekanze, a little bit like the Shakyamuni mantra, Muni Muni Maha Muneya. Also the vocative case, Beshanze or Bekanze, Bekanze, Maha Bekanze, Bekanze, Raja, or here the Tibetans say Raza, you know what Raja means, king. Samudgati Svaha. And then we didn't do, interestingly enough, we didn't do taking refuge in generating bodhicitta. So I will mention that in a minute. We did what's called the Four Immeasurables, which are common to all different Buddhist schools. These four thoughts that you are objects of meditation to dwell on. Wouldn't it be wonderful if all sentient beings had happiness and the cause of happiness? Here's the causes of happiness. Even your enemies, you know, strangers. That is what's called immeasurable love. It's said that if you were to meditate and even generate a thought, authentic thought from the depth of your heart, how wonderful it would be, or may all living beings, all sentient beings have happiness and the cause of this of happiness. Just if you were to generate that authentically, even for the time of a snap of your fingers, you would create immense amount of virtuous activity. We say karma, virtuous karma, or merit. More so than many people create in their whole lifetime, even spiritual beings, because of the power of that thought to leave an imprint in our mind. From Buddhist perspective, this is not our only time here. Not only is it that we will have some continuity in the future, which is shared with a lot of I think a lot of religions, certainly the peoples of the book, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, is that the word they use? Or the Abrahamic religions? They say there's something that comes after this, right? But not necessarily something that came before this, that we were created, our soul was created this lifetime. From a Buddhist perspective, we have, just as we will continue in the future, we have come here from the past in an infinite number of previous rebirths. So this can leave, having this thought of love, immeasurable love, can leave an imprint in our mind that can have its results in future lifetimes. We can already, as someone said the other day, talking about, you know, being born with these imprints in our mind, sort of hit the ground running. As a child, we'll already have perhaps a loving mind, and we won't have to sort of develop it the way that we might have to this lifetime. Not to say that you don't have a loving mind. I'm thinking of myself. Then the second one is, may all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. This is called immeasurable compassion. So like love, if you were to have even a moment of this authentically. You know, just saying the words is not enough. That's why when we recite these kinds of prayers and mantras and so forth, if you had previously meditated or got familiar with these things, spent time on each of the elements, it can call up to mind certain spiritual states simply by the words. Right now, just reciting the words might be some kind of nice feeling, but it doesn't necessarily bring about the same result as having meditated on the reasons to love all sentient beings, on the reasons to feel compassion for all living beings. If you were to do that with reason over a long period of time, then saying these words can bring up something that's very authentic. The third immeasurable thought is, may sentient beings be free, may all sentient beings be free from be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. This is what's called immeasurable joy. So when we see others who are prospering, having pleasure and so forth, rather than feeling jealousy for them, if we feel joy for them, if we rejoice in their happiness, and especially if we're skillful, understanding the Buddhist understanding of the law of cause and effect, what we call karma and its results, sort of the law of cause and effect on the mental realm, that for them to be experiencing happiness now means that they must have created some actions in a previous life, and thinking how wonderful that is. They are experiencing now the fruit of their past actions. Wouldn't it be wonderful if I created that same kind of action in the future? So instead of feeling jealousy if someone becomes wealthy or someone receives the job you were looking for, or you know, all the various reasons for jealousy, if you were to, instead of feeling jealous, if you were to rejoice in them, not only does it prevent you from falling into that negative state of mind of jealousy, it creates a vast amount of virtuous energy. And the last immeasurable thought is called immeasurable equanimity. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Now, naturally, we feel affection for our friends and family, and a little bit of antipathy for those who rub us the wrong way, our enemies. You know, is there anyone here who doesn't feel they have any enemies? Oh, you're a very virtuous crowd. So you don't have any enemies. That's very good. I think most people feel there's someone who rubs them the wrong way, that they feel some antipathy for, some hatred. So the state of equanimity is one in which you have spent time in recognizing that all these beings that are currently friends in future will not necessarily be recognizable. In a future lifetime, they may be in a completely different realm. They may be in the animal realm, you know. Maybe still friend, in this case, Charlie. They may be unrecognizable as strangers. They may actually, in a future life, be born as an enemy. Our present enemies, perhaps in a former life, have been very, very close to us. There's a story in the Buddhist history. One of the disciples of the Buddha had psychic powers, clairvoyance, and he was going around for alms in the morning. Do you know what alms are? Not almonds. Probably would have accepted almonds. Sometimes people think it is begging, but alms is ALMS, is when the monks, or in some case in India, the mendicants, the wanderers, would go with a bowl, and they would give an opportunity for the laity to create some merit by offering them food. You might say that's a euphemistic way, you know, like the monks are saying, we're giving you the opportunity to create merit by giving us food. You might be a bit suspect of that. But the monks, in return, offered spiritual guidance, their inspiration. They led meditation and provided the opportunity for people to take various kinds of vows where they could profit spiritually. So this one monk, he was called Maha Modgalyana. He's one of the monks in that tanka, that picture of the Buddha. He had clairvoyance. He was on his alms round, and he looked through the window of this house, and he saw a woman who was cooking some fish on the stove, for breakfast. And the husband was sitting at the table with a young child, holding the child, you know, loving it, saying sweet words. And there was a little dog yapping at his feet, and he was kicking the dog away. And he wondered what the relationship between these people were in the past. And he saw with his clairvoyance that the fish in the pan had previously been the father of this lady who owned this property, because he used to fish in the pond and kill those fish. He had been born karmically as in the animal realm as a fish. So she was frying her father. And the little child in the husband's arm had been his suitor for the wife, who he had defeated in, I'm not sure if he had killed him or, he had died before. He had been his enemy. Now he was his most cherished child. This is just to show the change. The little dog that's yapping at the feet, maybe wanting to get some of the fish that had been fried, was the mother of the woman who the wife of the husband who had fished. Now she was born as a dog who was being kicked. So this Modgalyana said, you know, how strange is our circle of lives. You know, the enemy becomes the most cherished. The father and mother become, objects of you kill or you kick. So like that, may all sentient beings abide in the state of equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. So to have that state of mind authentically again, thinking, meditating on it beforehand, can create a great deal of virtuous energy. That's why we recited that to begin with. So I'd like just for a couple of minutes to sit with you to do a little meditation. I assume some of you have never done meditation before. How many people have never meditated? Okay. Are you intimidated by that word? You say, what's, is it brainwashing or? What is that, brainwashing? Oh, I remember my teacher said sometime some people were criticizing the meditation course as like a concentration camp, and he said, that's good. Concentration, you know. not usually what you think of concentration camp. Also, brainwashing can be good too. One of a very popular Buddhist scholar these days, Robert Thurman. You heard of Robert Thurman? You might know because his daughter is a relatively famous movie star, Uma Thurman. He's been here. Last time I was here, we had lunch together. He gave some talks for the Center for Raising Funds. So he likes to liken one of the purposes of meditation, as he says, to reformat the human hard drive, you know, like your mind. It has been formatted, so to speak, with sort of wrong ideas about who you are and your perhaps superiority to others. Some people are inferior, some are superior to you. You are, you know, certain people are your enemies. Have to wipe that out. Start from scratch. Just see the clear nature of your mind and then rebuild from this, from the ground up with wholesome ways of looking at the world. So reformat the mental hard drive. So we're going to do that a little bit, okay? We won't be able to zap out your drive right now, don't worry. You'll still remember who you are after this. So sit comfortably and begin by simply watching your respiration without controlling it. In the same way that if I were to say, listen, you don't have to make a sound to listen to. There are many sounds that are there. Just watch the natural rhythm of your inhalation, the point where it changes direction, exhalation. While so doing, relax your body also. Just this itself can be very relaxing. You hear, you see sometimes this being suggested to people that are having a panic attack. Just breathe. Watch your breathing. But add some flavor to this in the sense that you let go of all other thoughts. Don't try to multitask. Don't let your mind be dwelling on other plans for the rest of the day or memories of yesterday or whatever drama happens to be present in your life right now. Just let go of those and just focus on the breathing. If you're honest with yourself, you may notice that it's not as easy as it might seem to let go of those other thoughts. You could replace them with, as you breathe in, with another more positive thought, thinking, as you breathe in, like this, I encounter friends, family. At the end of that inhalation, when you're just changing directions, when you abide with them for some time, when you exhale, thinking, just like this, we will inevitably separate, like the breath separating from your body. There'll be a period of empty at the end, and then meeting again, leaving space to meet new friends and family. And then let go of all of those thoughts and just focus on your mental consciousness. Focus with what? Focus with part of your mind, is like a little spy in the corner. Not your eye consciousness, not your ear, nose, tongue, or tactile consciousness, but your mental consciousness, your sixth consciousness within which you plan, remember, within which emotions arise, attachment, hatred, low self-esteem, jealousy, pride. Like a turtle pulling in its legs and head into the shell. Draw your attention away from the thoughts, away from your senses, to just your mental consciousness. If nothing dawns to your mind at all, so you have no idea what you're doing, imagine that the consciousness is like a vast space, clear sky, that doesn't form any obstruction to the birds flying through it, through the trees growing up into it, the clouds coming and going. And rather than focusing on the thoughts and images within your mind, focus on the spacious quality of the mind, which is the substratum for those thoughts to arise, the space within which they arise, the spaciousness of the mind. It's within this clear, unencumbered spaciousness of the mind, clean and clear, that we can develop ourselves spiritually. We can inspire ourselves to get rid of our faults, because they're not naturally part of our mind. They're just like appearances that arise within the mind, and they can be caused to dissolve back into it, the faulty things. With that in mind, think that I'm going to participate in the talk this morning to try to enhance this clear light nature of my mind, this vast spaciousness of the mind, to leave some positive thoughts within it, to try to subdue the negative thoughts that have plagued me all this life, perhaps, or might be plaguing me for some particular set of circumstances at this time. Not simply so I can relax, feel more happy about myself, but so in so doing that I will be a resource for others. I won't rub others the wrong way. I'll be less aggressive and angry and less road rage, and actually be able to benefit others. To really help others, we first have to get rid of our rough edges, our thoughts and actions that harm them. If we try to help before we've done that, our negative states of mind won't allow us to really help others authentically. But once we've gotten rid of the bad habits, we can enhance our good habits, generosity, love, compassion, and actually reach out and help others in a very authentic way. And then bring your attention back. Relax. I think maybe more than one of you said you hadn't meditated before, but I recognize this one lady. How was that experience? Oh, okay. She said she had a good time. Sometimes these are recorded. Well, not sometimes. I think they're always recorded. That's why some people with microphone may come. You might think you don't want to be a big star, but so the recording can hear the question or the answer, you know, like that. So, yeah, I think meditation is not some kind of strange indoctrination or something that's exclusive to Buddhism, although it's very often associated with Buddhism and some other spiritual traditions. What about Christianity? Some of you, I'm sure some of you or many of you have Christian background. Maybe you still consider yourself Christian. Is there, do you find the word meditation in the Christian church that you go to or the tradition? What?
I would say it's not mainstream. It's more for people that live in monasteries.
Did you hear that? She's saying it's probably not mainstream, but perhaps for people that live in monasteries. You mean the sweepers, the cooks? I'm just sure. You mean the monastics that live that live in the monastery, all right? So, oh, sorry.
Okay,
that's okay, Donna. Donna didn't need.
I'm on a delay.
Yeah, she's. It's like my Apple Watch. Every 10 minutes to the hour, it beeps to remind me to stand up. So this Donna's getting a chance to get rid of the stagnant blood in her body, legs. Generally, what you find in the Christian literature, according to my understanding, is the word contemplation, concept of contemplation. Let's contemplate. From a Buddhist perspective, almost exactly the same thing as meditation. It's just they use that word. I met a Christian priest, Catholic priest, in Italy once. We have a Buddhist center south of Pisa, in a little village there. And he happened to be visiting, and he was giving the mass in the village, but he came back. He had written his PhD thesis at Columbia many years ago. He was an American priest of Italian heritage. He had written his thesis on a great Tibetan saint called Milarepa, who some of you have heard of, the great meditator. So he was very versed in Buddhism. And I asked him why it was that Christians use the word contemplation rather than meditation. And he said, and I don't know if this just was off the top of his head or if this was a real etymology, but he said the word contemplation in the Christian sense, the etymology, the Christian etymology was contemplare, to join together with, con, templare, the plan of the temple of God in heaven. I was very touched. So like, to join with how things should be, you know, how things are in heaven. Contemplare, to contemplate, to join with the plan of, join together with the plan of heaven, the temple of God in heaven. Very interestingly, in Buddhism, the meditation is often referred to as a practice of yoga. Have you heard of yoga? I don't mean the physical exercises. That's often called hatha yoga or various kinds of yoga. Yoga doesn't mean just that physical kind of thing. It is the root of our English word yoke, like between two oxen, two cows, where you join together two things to reach one goal. So yoga is meant to join our ordinary self with what is authentic, to join with what is authentic. Contemplare, the same thing, to join with the plan of temple of God in heaven. So I like to think that Christians and Buddhists have the same, well, not just Christians, anyone who contemplates has the same goal, to try to overcome our obsession with just the here and now, the worldly, to join with something which is more meaningful, the authentic, either, if you like to say, the plan of the temple of God in heaven, or to join with the ultimate meaning of reality and so forth. This center is called the Kadampa Center. It's named for a group of practitioners, Buddhists in Tibet, maybe it was around 1200, I can't remember exactly when Atisha came to Tibet. This statue is of an Indian man, great spiritual saint, who came to Tibet and revivified the Buddhism there. His name was Atisha, and his followers were called the Kadampas. This center is called Kadampa Center. He was sometimes referred to as the Refuge Lama. Have you heard that before? The Refuge Guru. Refuge. So the verse that we hadn't recited here, maybe is recited in some cases, taking refuge and generating bodhicitta. I just wanted to mention what that means for those of you who are new, and to remind those of you who are older students of what that means. I like to be reminded again and again of these things. You might think that, like college courses, once you've taken, you've heard one teaching, you don't have to go back as long as you passed it. If you failed it, you have to go back, right? But in the spiritual realm, we feel that it's worthwhile revisiting these spiritual subjects again and again, because every time you hear them, it's like removing some obstacles from your mind. From the last time you heard them, you may have been practicing the spiritual path in some way. Maybe you've had some obstacles. But like peeling an onion, as you get closer and closer to the center, taking off one layer, getting closer and closer to the essence. Many people go to hear the same kinds of Buddhist teachings again and again, because with that fresh mind, you hear things that you had not heard before. Even going back and reading your notes of teachings, say the Dalai Lama gave or some other spiritual teacher gave, reading the notes that you wrote several years ago, you say, wow, there was so much there that I didn't catch at the time. If you were able to write down every, or read a transcript. So in that sense, those of you who are older students, you may say, well, I know about refuge already, but listen with a childlike mind, as Christ said. So I go for refuge. What does that mean? In Buddhism, the Buddha's first teaching that I mentioned, I gave a talk last Wednesday on the Four Noble Truths. And I will continue that this coming Wednesday about that and the 12 links of dependent arising. The four truths were the truth of suffering, the truth of cause of suffering, how that suffering can be eliminated, ceased in our minds, in our lives, and what's the method to bring that about, the path that leads to the cessation of suffering. So suffering is a concept that comes up a lot. It's not as though, the archetypal parochial school teacher, with the ruler who's hitting your hand when you do something like suffering. You have to do this penance. You were bad. I remember when I was a little boy, I must have been four. Before kindergarten, my mom and dad sent my brother and I to a preschool. It was a Catholic preschool. We weren't Catholic, but... And I remember my mouth being washed out by the sister with soap. I don't know what... Did you do that?
We did. I went to Catholic.
Oh, did you wash them out, or you got washed?
Let them wash my mouth out with soap.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So that might resonate with some of you. So here, the suffering is not like that kind of thing. You know, they suffer if you don't, if you're not good. It's a recognition of things that we may be oblivious of now. How life is fraught with loss, and even the things that we consider pleasure, if you really look at it, they never last. They're more or less a sense of relief. One suffering, you know, meeting someone, a new friend, some suffering of loneliness coming down, while the suffering of meeting that person, of being in relationship with that person, is still going up. That's called happiness, sort of relief. Oh, the loneliness is going away. Then after some time, when you're with that person for some time, oh, you know, you don't have to talk so loud. You don't have to slurp your tea. You know, there'll be some kind of little irritations in the relationships, maybe. From what I understand, a good number of marriages end up in divorce. What is it nowadays in the States?
52, I think,
52%. Here's a man who's well-read. I'm not sure I knew that it was exactly 52%. So what can we do if we begin to recognize the suffering nature of life, the unsatisfactory nature of life? We need to find, like when it's raining, we'll look for some shelter, a refuge from the rain. Like at the bus stop, you don't want to stand out in the rain, you go under the bus shelter, right? So refuge has that kind of sense. In a spiritual sense, how can we seek refuge? Well, in the Christian tradition, we may seek, although we don't use that word in Christianity, it may be something like that. We call Christ the Savior, right? In Christian sense. And so he'll save you from your bad instincts, from suffering, is a refuge, taking, you know, putting your trust in Christ and so forth. From a Buddhist perspective, there are the Buddha himself, his teachings, which are the actual refuge, and the spiritual community who are putting those teachings into practice. Those are called the three jewels of refuge. One of my friends, who had been a monk for many years in the Tibetan tradition, he's dealt a lot with publications. Dr. Nick, you know Dr. Nick, right? He reviewed a book that was published in India. Sometimes the editing in India and the publishing is not so precise as in the West. And he was pointing out that in this one book, it was talking about the three Jews of refuge. He said, that's a misprint. You know, should be the three Jews. He said, but if it's the three Jews, I don't know. Because he was Jewish. Dr. Nick was a Jewish. So he said, there's myself and Alex Berzin and John Landau. But who's, you know. So we say the three jewels, the tri-ratna. Tri, like tricycle in Sanskrit, also means three. Ratna means jewels. So the real refuge from a Buddhist perspective are the Buddhist teachings, what the Buddha taught. From a Buddhist perspective, many of Christ's teachings, some of the teachings of the Old Testament also, of the Quran, some of them that are, sometimes one sees things that are a little bit suspect, one's not quite sure, but the teachings that elevate the mind, that help to prevent the mind from suffering. Those are the real refuge from suffering. So we take, in a Buddhist sense, at the beginning of teachings, we take refuge in the Buddha, his teachings, and the spiritual community. Here at the first line of that second, well, where it says, taking refuge in generating bodhicitta. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. Dharma is an Indian word that refers to, well, the root of it means to hold up. So it's what holds you from suffering, what keeps you from suffering, protects you from suffering. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. The Supreme Assembly means those Buddhists who are already have a deep insight into reality. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So here's a different attitude than we would find in Christianity. I think if a little child if you were to go to a family and ask a little child, a Christian child, what they wanted to be, if they said, "I want to be God," what would be the response of the parents? No, you can't be God. It's God, it's, you know. From a Buddhist perspective, you can become Buddha. You can become, we will evolve into our highest state of omniscient mind when we develop this wish to help others and work for a long period of time to create the causes for that, the good heart and the wisdom. Christ himself said he was not God. He was the Son of God, which is interesting because in the Buddhist teachings, those beings who are aiming to become Buddha are called the sons of the Buddha. Just as when a king gives birth to a son in ancient India and other cultures, the young prince is revered as by all the ministers as being someone destined to become king. When someone has generated this particular state of mind, wishing to become perfect for the sake of others, so that I can help others in the most perfect way, that special mind is called bodhicitta. Bodhi means enlightenment, citta means mind, a mind aiming for enlightenment. So just for those of you who have just come, just to give a little outline of these prayers, when you come, if you come again, hope you come again, so you have some idea of why we're reciting those things. Before I go any further, I just see if leave some space for you to ask questions or make comments. Feel free, this young lady. Yeah. Yeah, you don't have to, but this is nice for the recording.
I really appreciate how you teach using etymology. It's really helpful for me.
Mm-hmm.
What does the word sangha mean? Like, what's the origin?
Which word?
Sangha?
Oh, sangha. Sangha is a Sanskrit word that means community or group. So in the case of Buddhism, it refers to the group of disciples. Originally, at the time of the Buddha, there were five original people that he taught. And like, you know, what Christ said with his disciples? What did he say when they became disciples? Come on, you Christians. Follow me, right? Huh? Yeah, follow me. Something like that, right? When the Buddha taught and people wanted to become his disciples, he said something very similar. So they became like his, in Christianity we say the disciples were the very close ones, what was it, eventually 12 disciples that we generally recognize, right? From the Buddhist perspective, the very close community expanded over time from that five to thousands of disciples, and they were called the community, the Sangha. So when we take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, we're taking refuge in the person who attained this omniscient mind, Shakyamuni Buddha, and from that state of compassion and wisdom, exposed how things are, explained how things are, the Dharma, and those who were actually practicing it from a very authentic point of view. There are a couple of other synonyms for Sangha. Like in the prayer here it says, the Supreme Assembly. Soki Chogun. The Supreme Assembly. So that's referring to the Sangha who have realized the ultimate truth directly. So they can be relied on as nurses. So sometimes we say the Buddha is like the doctor who has analyzed our situation, prescribed the medicine of the Dharma, and the Sangha are those beings who are putting those practices in, putting those teachings into practice themselves, and help us like nurses, or the, what is it called, PA? What's a PA? Physician's assistant, yeah? Nurse practitioner. The Sangha are like PAs, nurse practitioners, or nurses who help us to take the medicine by their example, you know, the spiritual community, or in interaction with them when they give advice and teachings and so forth. Anyone else have a thought? Yes. Donna's gone off with her microphone. Oh. Why don't you grab that other microphone while Donna's gone. Yes.
So I have two questions.
Okay.
One of them is, so we can come back to this earth as another animal, any other species, in other words. But we can be related to someone in many different ways. I thought that you would come, what is the reason why I can come as an enemy, as your enemy next time, and be your sister, your beloved sister?
Right.
It seems
strange. From a Christian tradition, I'm using Christianity mainly. I should also give examples from Judaism. I don't know that much about Judaism or Islam. So I'm using Christianity because many people have a common Christian background. So from a Christian point of view, if you were to go to heaven, correct me if I'm wrong, there's an assumption, a lot of people say, oh, you will be together with your family for eternity, right? So it's like no change.
Mm-hmm.
From a Buddhist perspective, our relationship right now is one that has the fact that we've just met. Many of you may have never seen me before. Some of you have come to some of the classes, have seen me before, but you might think this is just a random occurrence. From a Buddhist perspective, there's no way that we could be together here as a group right now, especially listening to spiritual teachings, unless we created some connection in past lives, what we call a karmic connection. That means in the very act of being together and paying attention to one another, maybe perhaps thinking, oh, this is interesting to do this spiritual practice. Unless we created that connection, there's no way for us to be here right now. Like, say, for instance, in an airplane that crashes. You've heard the stories. Let's say everyone on the plane dies except for one or two people. Have you heard stories like that?
Mm-hmm.
No, or accidents, train accident or something like that. So there were that group of people on the plane had in some previous life or lives created some collective action that wasn't beneficial. Maybe they killed a cow together, or they criticized or they bombed some village, or they fought together and killed others. But let's say if there were 100 people on the plane, two didn't die in the plane crash. But of those 100 people in a previous life, when they created some bad action together, two of them may have been hesitant, like, I don't want to go. You know, like when kids go out and break windows, maybe a lot of the gang are joining together and there'll be a couple of people who don't want to do that, and they're sort of with the people, but they have hesitancy and they shy back from really completing the action. So those individuals who experienced the crash and the trauma but survived are individuals like that who didn't complete the complete action. So when we're reborn, even though one lifetime, let's say the father of the story that I told at the beginning, who had fished, even though he loved his daughter and perhaps her her eventual husband, or maybe even the suitor before that the husband killed, even though he loved them, now, because of his very strong actions in some previous life, we refer to the actions that we create. It's like planting seeds. Like, and I think that's a very good example. Like Christ said in the Bible, "Ye reap what ye sow." Do they still say that in the new translations of the Bible, or do they use modern language? You're going to harvest the seeds that you,
yeah,
your tractor has planted. Okay. So what that means is, having created actions, good or bad, it's like planting seeds in our mind. What is going to ripen first in your next lives are the ones that are most potent. We could say heaviest karma, heaviest deeds. So in the case of the father who had fished, some of his actions were more negative actions that he had created in the past, were heavier than the loving relationships he had with his children. They ripen, that ripened first as being born as, in the animal realm as a fish.
I see. Okay.
In the case of the suitor of the husband, remember the story. So the husband had either killed him or he died independently, I can't remember which. Even though he had some kind of jealousy and he wanted the wife, he was defeated, still some good karma because of his attachment to the wife. He was born as a child. That was heavier than some of the other karmic seeds in his mind stream. So if we would like to continue practicing a spiritual path from a Buddhist perspective, it's very incumbent upon us to try to eliminate as many of those negative seeds in our mind of actions we've done in the past. It's possible to purify those negative actions we've created, negative karma that we've created in the past.
Even in this lifetime?
Yes. In this lifetime, we can purify actions we created in past lifetimes and negative actions we created just yesterday or earlier in this life. We hit our mom, we stole money from our dad, or we, who knows, different kinds of negative actions that we did. So there are the main component to purify those negative actions is the mental state of regret, remorse. There are three other, these are the four opponent forces, but the main one is regret. Not guilt, thinking, oh, I did that, I'm a bad person. That already, from a Buddhist perspective, is counterproductive. But a state of mind that recognizes I was unskillful. I said harsh words, I lied, I stole out of jealousy, I told stories about that person so someone else would like me, or the whole spectrum of things that we might regret. Being lazy, stealing, lying, killing. Feeling strong regret, understanding that those actions we created were unskillful in the sense that they left imprints in our mind that will bring about suffering to us in the future. And with a more noble motivation, not just worried about my own suffering, recognizing when those negative actions ripen on us as something negative, we'll be in less able to help others. We'll either be poor or ugly or incapable of helping, not having the freedom to practice a spiritual path. We won't have resources to give to others. Mm. So with that more noble motivation, also to purify, feeling regret of the actions that we've done, that is the most, of the four opponent forces, which you can hear about in other times, that's the most essential. I think we would say that's something similar in the other religions. There are sentiments like that. In I think in Judaism, my knowledge is just like having heard radio programs about where they talked about, I think in Judaism to confess or, you know, if you've done something bad, you have to confess to the person who you harmed and receive their,
forgiveness.
You have to receive their, from Buddhist perspective, doesn't matter whether they forgive you or not. Of course, it's good, if you can, to ask for forgiveness, but sometimes that can make the situation worse. So just to feel strong regret and to make a very strong determination not to act that way in the future. Mm-hmm. Now, you said you had more than one question,
yes.
So that was one, right?
The second one is coming from a woman's perspective. Everywhere that I have ever been, you know, attending other, I should say, going to see other, observing other religions, it's always male-dominated.
Yeah.
And so my question is, the only religion that I have ever encountered that I really feel close to and I feel that I, there's something about it that I like it, is Buddhism. But I have never heard of any woman Dalai Lama. Why is that?
Well, could be. Dalai Lama, this is very interesting. Recently the Dalai Lama said, you know, there's a big controversy. The Dalai Lama is about 10 years older than I. I'm 74, so he's 84. And there, people are worried about his health if he dies. The communist Chinese have stated they will decide who the next Dalai Lama is, like it's like a position you appoint.
Oh my God.
From a Buddhist perspective, again, it's talking about continuity of life. When the Dalai Lama dies, his mind stream will take rebirth again in the future. It's not like you can just decide yourself. You need to have some spiritual power, some prowess, to know where that being was reborn that will continue that. So the Dalai Lama said, it's very possible that I may come back as a woman. And there was some controversy recently in our woke age. Do you know that word, woke? Have you heard it? Woke?
Woke.
Oh, you're younger people know. How, you have to pronounce it a certain way? Okay, oh, I thought she said woke. You have to say it a certain way.
No.
So
I don't know what it is.
It means the recognition that women have been subjugated and that oftentimes their accusations or, let's say accusations, their submissions that they have been inappropriately sexually abused or impoverished in terms of power and pay and so forth, to recognize that. This is, I think that's part of the essence of woke. I'm not sure. Is there some other element? Have you got it right? So there was one article in a magazine that said, the title was Bad Opinion of the Week.
Huh?
Bad Opinion of the Week. That was the headline. And it was about the Dalai Lama saying that if he came back as a woman, he would have to come back as a beautiful woman.
What? This is nonsense.
Yeah, take it easy. I'll explain. Okay. So,
bad.
So he was saying, which the woke movement should feel happy about. He's saying there's no reason Dalai Lama has to come back as a man other than in the past we have generally been in patriarchal societies where the most influential and powerful kind of personality would be a male. Now we recognize because of our intelligence, we recognize the equality, and we try to make that more part of our society, the equality between male and female. In numberless lives, you've been a male. Numberless lives, I've been a female also. There's nothing, even in one lifetime, one can change genders, right? So there's something to keep in mind. So the Dalai Lama said, in the future life, he could come back very well, possible he could come back as a woman, but as a beautiful woman. So this, the woke movement was very upset about that from the point of view as though if he was an unattractive woman, it wouldn't be good. You know, trying to say that whether you're ugly or beautiful or in between, you should be valued the same way. That wasn't his point. Saying that whatever, there's a certain amount of charisma that's associated with individuals. Some of it has to do with your appearance or your It depends on the society. So,
because to me, it's very disturbing. Everywhere that I go.
To me,
it's very disturbing that everywhere that I go is patriarchal. I understand that this happened. Actually, there is it started 10,000 years ago with the institution of agriculture. That's when our society really became patriarchal. But, you know, because...
When our society became what?
Became patriarchal.
Oh, patriarchal.
But, this is the 2019.
So there, we know...
Things should change, like,
right,
really
right.
fast.
But sometimes, well, you know, I don't want to give a political speech. When you try to change things too quickly, there's going to be backlash. So, you know...
It's 10,000 years.
Yeah, but...
not too quickly.
Yeah, but you're talking about today is still the same as it was 10,000 years ago. So to change it today, sometimes you're going to be with some resistance. From a Buddhist perspective, there is no difference in spiritual capability between humans or animals even that are male or female or what's the other thing nowadays? Non-gender or transgender or...
All those things.
There's no difference in the spiritual capacity except for the fact that dominated by society. What hindrances might be inherent in society? In earlier times, and correct me if it's different now, if you were to go to a cave, an isolated cave, to meditate, you were a meditator, and you wanted to really make some spiritual progress without, you know, the complications of community life and family and everything. You're going off to a cave like an ascetic mm-hmm. meditator. Do you think that you would be safer from thieves and robbers as a woman or a man?
Well, in my case, that would have been different because
yeah.
I'm different.
Yeah, yeah. I can see. I would steal from you. I mean, that's for sure. But and then we could go the other way and say, I could ask you, which gender would be more likely the robbers and heavy, you know, people who would use their force to steal? Generally, we'd say men.
Mm-hmm.
But also that's sexist. But that happens to be. That happens to be the case in the past and the future, in the past and even the present. So one just has to take those things into consideration to recognize that although things are not ideal, as my teacher used to say, we've come a long way, baby. Remember that there was some Virginia Thins or something? Virginia Slims.
Yep.
Cigarette. We've come a long way, baby. From even 20 years ago, you know, let alone 10,000 years ago. This is incredible. So I agree with you. There will, as the Dalai Lama says, there can be, will be maybe, female Dalai Lamas in the future. There are many great female Buddhist teachers. Maybe in the past, because in the past in Tibet there was still, like our own society, a patriarchal remnant. They did not have the same opportunities. Women didn't have the same opportunities. But the Dalai Lama has made a lot of programs to recognize female teachers. In fact, I believe, was it here the first female Geshe? Oh, was it Washington, D.C.? Did you have a...
She was here.
So one, I think, German, Austrian lady became Buddhist nun, and in the past she would not have been able to receive this particular title of teacher. It's called Geshe. Geshe means spiritual friend, literally, but it's a title that's given to those who have studied the very deep text in a very comprehensive way, kind of like a PhD or even beyond, post-grad. And she was the first woman who received this title, I believe, the first Western woman, anyway. Maybe there was a Tibetan there. And she has been going around. The Dalai Lama has asked for centers to invite her and so forth as an example for others, inspiration for other women, that you can do this too. Mm. So there's a recognition of this, And I think it's attempting to be redressed now. So good
thank
question.
You. Thank
yeah,
you.
Thank you. Someone else have a question or thought? Yeah. This gentleman was first. Yeah.
Yeah, you helped a little bit with the previous answer. It was about the story with the fish and the dog and the
yes.
father. And it's kind of in the weeds a little bit on it, but the whole rebirth thing has always been somewhat confusing with me with the, you know, just the magnitude of conscious bodies that drop in and out of this realm. The probabilities of like them reappearing in the same like community and like, I mean, it's not specifically important to think about like your friend dying and like reappearing all of a sudden in your same community, right? It's like, it's the idea that it could be anybody reappearing in that community. But it seems that like some people want to specifically like put a title like this person obviously was like somebody in a past life that was like, and I don't know how helpful it is to go about thinking about things like that.
So it's very difficult, unless we have clairvoyance, which probably most of us don't have, like this great saint who looked through the window, had the clairvoyance, a very highly evolved person. Probably unlikely that our loved ones will be reborn with us again, like as a dog or, you know, Charlie, who knows? Who Charlie is. Charlie is his dog in Jason's lap, right? Maybe might have been an enemy from very many lives ago. Might have been a friend from many lives ago that happens to be born here now. So there's no way for us to tell, you know, about that. There's an expression, we are thrown by the winds of karma. When we die, which from a Buddhist perspective is the moment in which the subtlemost consciousness leaves this body, when it severs its connection with the continuum of this body, and the body is inert. It's not the time when in the medical movies where the, you know, the screams, oh, time of death, 10:15. From a Buddhist perspective, perhaps the mind, the subtlemost mind is still within that body. But after some time, when the mind leaves, it might be just a matter of a day or hours, or it could for a meditator, the mind can remain in the body that looks to be dead for 3 days, 16 days, even longer for high meditators. They're meditating with a very subtle mind. But when that subtle mind leaves, the karma, which was ripening in that mind, because these, like to use this agricultural analogy again, we've planted seeds in our mind stream, good and bad, from past actions and actions this lifetime. At the time of death, they are accelerated in their growth, which one is going to ripen and bring its result. The ones which are heaviest will ripen in our next rebirth. So those karma, the seeds might have been from thousands of lives ago. It also depends on what happens to be in our environment as a possible rebirth. We may have karmic seeds on our mind to be reborn as dinosaurs. But if we die today, we won't be born in this world as a dinosaur, unless it's a Jurassic Park kind of clone or something like that, because there's no cooperative condition. We might be born in another universe where there are dinosaurs being born, if that's the strongest seed. So it's very difficult to judge that we would. This example was like an extreme example. Out of extreme attachment to the farm, the father was born there. He had bad habit of fishing and killing the fish, which brought him rebirth as a fish. But the fish was born in that particular pond because of his great attachment to that.
It's an allegory.
You could say it's an allegory. From certain Buddhists would believe that it's actually reflecting reality, but you can also understand it as an allegory. Yeah. It depends on your degree of confidence or faith in whether these are actually reflecting reality or if it's just allegorical. Okay. This gentleman has a question?
So I've been kind of speaking truth and feeling the peace and serenity of when you see reality and awareness of the world as it is. How does Buddhism relate to Hinduism and Zen? Like, are there fundamental differences? Do you disagree?
There are fundamental, on a certain level, philosophical differences between all of these spiritual traditions. Let's say, you didn't mention Christianity, but I'll go back to Christianity, I'll go back to those two, the Hinduism and Zen, as it goes on. But from a Christian perspective, our soul was created at the time of birth. If I'm correct me if I'm wrong, one of the general assumptions in the philosophical view of Christianity is that God created our soul at some point, at the time of conception or later, when we're born, and that it will continue on eternally, either in perhaps even in heaven or in hell, according to different denominations' philosophical views, or sometimes in the, what's it called? No, in Christianity, what's it called? Purgatory. It's almost like from a Buddhist perspective, you know, again being thrown back into the world. You have to work out your sins or something. Hinduism has various, what we call Hinduism is a modern name given to the Vedic religions that depended on the Vedas, the ancient scriptures of India that talked about the various gods, the creator, Brahma of the world, and so forth. And it has both theistic and non-theistic varieties. So you actually worship deities, and some don't worship deities. They just do different kinds of meditation. The very special thing that distinguishes those non-Buddhist traditions from Buddhism is the Buddhist insight into what he called selflessness. And again, as I mentioned the other day, selflessness doesn't mean like when we say Mother Teresa was a selfless person, you know, that someone who just cares for others more than themselves. It's a deep insight into recognizing, like, what's your name?
Brett.
That who you think you, you know, when you say, I, Brett, if I ask you who you are, you'll be thinking, I'm a man, I'm a engineer or whatever, a doctor, teacher, I'm employed, unemployed, retired, worker, different kinds of things of what we think we are. If you get beyond that, sort of the outer shell, who we really think we are, there's a sense of self-identity. If I say, Brett, you're dumb. You know, it's not like your body is dumb or maybe you think your mind is dumb, but there's like something, a real self that's been offended. Somehow, maybe in the heart. It's that sense of self that the Buddha's special insight was that particular thing we're thinking is there doesn't exist at all. You could say, how could it not exist? It's so apparent. The reflection in the mirror, out of the corner of your eye, you see someone in the corner of your eye wearing if I'm going to see someone in Rome, say, oh, there's another monk, and I turn, it's my reflection. There was something happening, just like there's something happening in our mind that appears to be a self, but I see that reflection is empty of me, is devoid of another, empty of me, is devoid of being another person. There's nothing there that I thought was there. There's something happening, like a mirage. We impute there's water there until we recognize it's devoid of water. So the Buddha's special insight was that indeed this soul, if you want, Atma in Sanskrit, seems to be there. The Hindu religion believes that Atma exists in some fundamental way. From Buddhist perspective, there's anatma, no Atma, selfless. We are selfless. That's a special insight that distinguishes it from Hinduism. Zen is a type of Buddhism. You've mentioned Zen. Zen meditation is a particular flavor that fits the Japanese personality, simplicity, just a lot of emphasis on meditation. But even in Zen Buddhism, there are various traditions, some of which are more scholarly, almost like Tibetan scholarly tradition. So it's it's hard to say. Zen Buddhism is akin to Tibetan Buddhism, or because they're both what are called Mahayana. They're the great vehicle. They're aiming to achieve enlightenment, to become Buddha for the sake of other sentient beings. We've got time for another question. Now, several men have asked questions. Jason, would you be willing to let this young lady have the last question? Or maybe the two ladies. There's one behind the lady on the seat and the one behind her also afterwards.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say, I think some of the things you said are really beautiful to me, that this idea that everybody in this room, we're all kind of long-lost brothers and sisters, and like instead of looking at her and seeing a stranger to think, oh my God,
yeah, could be my mother,
sister,
yeah.
Or my mother,
yeah, yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah, right.
And then to the thought of taking it out into the real world. Well, maybe it's not just us who are brought together spiritually, but Joe down at the Starbucks.
Yeah.
You
yeah,
know,
okay.
Like
yeah.
It really, I think by adopting that belief, then it helps me to be kind and loving and have a more generous spirit towards people if I'm projecting that onto them.
Right. So that's interesting that you said belief, because from a Buddhist perspective, that particular understanding for us for a long time will be just at the level of belief, because we don't have the clairvoyance to see our past lives now. It's possible to develop clairvoyance that can actually perceive the relationships with these people.
Right.
But that's a long way off. So for us, it's a matter of belief and faith right now. It said one of the more difficult, on the basis of that, one can develop an incredible sense of love and compassion for others, because they have, every one of you, male and female, have been my mother in some other lifetime. I was a cockroach, I was a goose, I was in the God realm or as a human, rich, poor, in between. Each and every one of you have been my mother many, multiples, millions, billions of times over the beginningless lives in the past. And just like in this lifetime, if we were to be separated from our mother of birth, a long time we haven't seen her, and then we hear, maybe we do 23andMe or one of these ancestry.com, and say, oh, your mother is in a sanatorium or in a hospital, and we, you know, that's your biological mother, and you're coming to see, you don't quite recognize her because it's been 50 years or something, just like now. You don't recognize someone as your mother, but understanding that she's your mother, a great well of compassion and love wells up in you, know, you would like to help in some way. So with that kind of understanding, that all living beings have been our mother or our father, or very close, and helped us in so many ways in the past, one can develop a heartwarming, you know, affection for them that can develop into real love and compassion. Okay, so thank you.
And I also like the talk about your enemies. Like you, it seems like you really take all the vitriol out of an enemy. Like, oh well, last time I knew him, he was my sister,
right?
Or
right,
or whatever.
Right.
So like, I don't have to blow it out of proportion that
right.
somebody displeases
well,
me.
Well, we know in this lifetime, brothers and sisters can be enemies. You know, in fact, sometimes think those are the worst enemies, right? But to recognize that you have that common connection can diffuse that kind of sense of anger and so forth. And the last question, lady behind, yeah?
Yeah.
Remind me of your name?
My name is
Lois. Hi, Lois.
And hello there. I want, first of all, thank you for so many things that we can ponder about here. But also, I want to thank you very deeply for your beautiful meditation part this morning. And I have always thought I need to be doing that and never fully get into it at all, because our God Almighty told us to be still and know that I am. And there's no other way to do that other than to clear our mind of all the chatter and all the things that go on there all the time. So you helped me to be able to do that there this morning, and I'm very grateful for
that.
And I thank you, sir.
So, remind me who the author of the great Christian text, usually translated as the cloud of unknowing. Who is it? Great.
I don't know that. I just know that I have read that in my Bible many times, and I'm sorry, I'm not one who.
No. It's okay. I'm just
says, oh yes.
Because it correlates with what you're saying, that some of the desert fathers at the time of Christ, almost like ascetics, monks in the desert, their meditations were very much like that, this finding stillness. Christ is said to have retreated in some famous incidents in the Bible, like when things got too hectic, he retreated to the forest or where the desert.
Very important for us
to be still and quiet. Right. So from a Buddhist perspective, that's the first step. You have to quiet the mind and then to develop good virtuous states within that.
Well, each morning when I read my word and my other books and say my prayers, that's my quiet time to do that. And I know that many of you, including my daughter and my son-in-law here, do that every day. And that's the only way that we can have peace throughout our day, in my thought.
Yeah.
But I do appreciate you, sir, and George.
Thank you, Lois. be personal there. So I don't want to keep any of you, so we're supposed to end at 12. It's 12:04, according to my Apple Watch. But this gentleman, if any of you have questions, maybe you can stay. I'll stay a couple of minutes after. We can chat casually, but I'd like to just finish with a moment of, again, calming our minds and what we call dedication of the energy. So relax your body, which sometimes is difficult enough, but more importantly, relax your mind. To let it go back to that quiet state, if you can recall it. And then think positively. We've created some positive energy this morning in listening to the talk, perhaps developing some good thoughts. Maybe some of you developed some, you know, because of my inappropriate speech or something. Maybe you got angry at some point. But in general, you've perhaps created a vast store of good actions that will have repercussions in the future. In the same way, if you were to receive your income tax check at the end of the year, you know, you get $200, $500 back or whatever, and you might dedicate that, put it in a safe deposit box or cash it, dedicate that money to your retirements or your children, grandchildren's college education. Here, dedicate these merits. Aspire, wish that these merits not ripen simply in some worldly happiness in the future, but that they might be the fuel, the fertilizer for our future spiritual growth. Becoming better people for our own sake and especially for the sake of others, so we don't harm others and that we can actually benefit them in a positive way. Due to these merits that we've created today, may we eventually reach our highest potential, whether you call it Buddha or omniscient mind, for the sake of all living beings. Thank you very much. And if you have interest, I'll give another talk tomorrow night on...
I'll make a little announcement.
Okay, but just I'll just say quickly, and Wednesday I'll give a talk here. You can find out more information later. Next weekend there will be a seminar, more advanced seminar on higher meditative practices. It's been a pleasure to be here with you. And
So just very quickly, tomorrow night is the Discovering Buddhism, Death and Rebirth. Wednesday night, Venerable George will continue teaching on the Four Noble Truths, which was the Buddha's first teaching, and how that relates to the 12 links of dependent origination. Thursday night, he's going to teach on the Heart Sutra, which was the Buddha's teaching on emptiness, using translation sort of as your
tool for explicating the Heart Sutra or using the Heart Sutra to explicate translation. And next weekend is a whole Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday on how to meditate on emptiness. And this book is a resource that he's going to be using for that, so we do have some copies of that. And I think Jill needs to make a quick announcement. So we'll have a newcomer orientation here, and Susan, Heather in the back will do that, and then there's a new member orientation, which Jill will do out in the lobby, and I think that's all we've got. Okay. No, we do have more. Do we have more? We do have more. Is there more after? Am I the last? Okay. Okay, great. So I'm Susan Potter. I am so happy to be here and announce for you the 2020 annual appeal. We know this happens every year when we do some fundraising for the center to have support our wonderful program, including, thank you, Venerable George, for being here. I'm going to ask you to just hold that for me. If you are a member or on our mailing list, you will have already received the Look to the Future brochure. And if you have missed that, there are some out in the lobby that you can pick up. If you take just 30 seconds, you can open this brochure and see what our program has looked like. That there's a little chart that gives our income side, our expense side. It's a picture is worth a thousand words. You can see exactly what's going on here with just a quick glance at this brochure, which, thank you, one of our nice graphic designer members who put this together nicely for us. One interesting fun fact in the brochure is that we currently have 92 monthly supporters, and last year with the same annual campaign, we had 79 one-time supporters, people who wrote checks, credit card, texted their donation, whatever. So we have a good base of support. Also in this packet is a letter from Robbie Watkins, our director, and Sandy Carlson, our president of the board of directors. And when you see this letter, there's another quick little list, some bullets that you can glance down and see what our program is about. Teachings, community and monastic community for leading our spiritual programs. We had Geshe Gelug has been here for over 20 years. Geshe Tsongpo has been here, the two PhD-type teachers that we have. We support a prison project. We have a fabulous family and children's program. Lama Zopa Rinpoche has been here, and we continue to offer retreats that he strongly suggests that we do. The last bullet point on here is that we ignited the curiosity and growth of thousands of spiritual seekers through in-person classes, retreats, and programs, as well as through streaming and online content. And it really isn't a stretch to say thousands of people, because through these over 20-some years, hundreds of people come through the classes. This Gompa is full today. We really have touched, the center has touched the lives of of thousands of people. Exactly. Oh, that's right. All the online content. So this brings us to where we are today. And I have to read this because it's a little confusing for me. Those of us who have been here over the years in the past didn't know exactly what the center would look like in the future, which is now. So back in the 90s, we didn't know what the 2010s right now would look like. We didn't know what this would look like. We didn't know what the altar. We didn't know that you would be here or you, Lois, would be here. We didn't know that Venerable George would be here today. We just had a hope and a confidence and aspiration that some form of our being able to offer the Dharma would be here. In the past, we had a vision, but it was a sight unseen in a way. Those aspirations from the past and the groundwork that was laid, all the work finding the new building, creating the altar, all the discovering Buddhism teachings, meditation, 101, all the annual appeals we've had, all of the dollars given, all of this has laid the groundwork for where we are right now. So today, in the present, today we don't have a clear idea exactly of what our future will look like,
but we're excited, we're spacious, and we have unlimited hopes about sharing the Dharma in the future. And it's these hopes and intentions which are the volition or the energy that will help determine what the future looks like for the center. So right now, the present is the fruition of our past. And at the same time, the present is the foundation for our future. The past is this unbroken series of yesterdays, and the future is an unbroken series of tomorrows. So, hopefully tomorrow when I wake up inspired from this teaching, I will wake up and say, oh, today's Monday. What can I do today to be of service to others? Then the day after that, if I can remember to be this inspired, I will say, ah, today is Tuesday, the day after Monday. What can I do today to be of service to others? So, it's these series of tomorrows, the close tomorrows, the tomorrows from a week away, the tomorrows from years away, that will determine our future. So thank you for everyone who's ever offered any support, dollars, donations, volunteering, prostrations, anything in the past, our long ago past, our recent past. Thank you for all of your thoughts and considerations about the Dharma and as we look to the long-term future. So as we do this and we think about these series of tomorrows, please don't join us in the appeal, the brochure, and please don't stop thinking about tomorrow.